Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll visit with perhaps television's most entertaining OBGYN at the Mindy Project, which has just returned for its new season. Then we'll broaden out to romantic comedy, the genre that inspired Mindy in the first place. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'd like to recommend the newest NPR podcast, Embedded. Each week, Embedded takes you to a new place out in the world, searching for the people behind a headline. Listen and subscribe to Embedded now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We're rom-comming it up this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Audie Cornish, what do you do at NPR?
I am a host at All Things Considered.
And joining us from the studios of WBUR in Boston is Margaret Willison. Margaret, what do you do with yourself?
Boy, this is a lot of hats, but I'm a librarian. I'm one half of the newsletter Two Bossy Dames. I'm one third of the podcast Appointment Television, and I like to call myself the putative victor of the imaginary TV show America's Next Top Best Friend.
Yes, you do. I absolutely believe that that is the truth. Well, one of the reasons why we're so happy to have Audie and Margaret here, and we did give Thompson the week off. He's watching watchfully from the studio. But Audie and Margaret are both like me, people who watch a little Mindy Project from time to time. This is Mindy Kaling's show, which started out on Fox for a few seasons, but then has moved over to being Hulu only, which is an interesting development. She plays an OBGYN who started off, I would say, more selfish and awful and perhaps has become less selfish and awful. We can talk a little bit about that. Glenn, are you also a Mindy watcher?
I started the show back when it started on Fox many years ago, and it wasn't my jam. You know, I watched it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed her.
Yeah.
But I kind of saw the first three or four episodes and thought it wasn't for me. Ultimately, what seemed fresh about the show, which was having somebody like Mindy Kaling look like that, that person
sure.
on American television.
Sure.
Was fresh, wasn't quite fresh enough to bring up all the very familiar stuff about the show, the infrastructure of the show, the wacky male nurse, all the stuff that kind of unrails. Now, I have a question for you guys, because the showrunner of The Mindy Project was interviewed and said that he didn't think that people knew that there was going to be some romance between her and the character of Danny early on in the running of the show. Would you agree with that?
I have on occasion, because I am a fan of the show, I went and rewatched early episodes, and I could see they were positioning her to possibly have a relationship with another doctor on the show.
The British one,
The
right?
British one, yeah. He was doing very much a Hugh Grant CAD routine.
Yeah, he sure was.
And over time, that changed. I will say that when I watched those early episodes, I thought, oh, this isn't a show I would watch. And its infrastructure changed a lot over the course of the season, and it landed on something that I really enjoyed. It's still silly, but it was much better sort of structured by the time it ended at season one, I think.
Yeah. How about you, Margaret? What was your early take?
I completely agree with Audie. I came into the show with really high expectations because Kaling's character on The Office, Kelly Kapoor, was one of consistently the best things that show did. And I'm just a huge fan of her comedic voice and identity. She's just a really cool person. And the first few episodes of the show I thought were not good. It was just mean and not funny. And I thought they were putting Danny and Mindy together as like antagonistic, but ultimately they're going to kiss. And I was like, oh, God, never have them kiss because they're terrible to each other. And over the course of the season, it's just one of those shows that grew into itself. The cast chemistry got better. Mindy's idea of how to write for herself and like how to be selfish but also likable got way, way better.
Yeah, because she's deeply committed to that premise.
Right.
Yeah, and
very
she
much
is.
So.
She's a gently terrible person, just like Liz Lemon is.
Interesting.
But it's gently, specifically terrible. And it's one of those things where it's like once you know your friend's quirks, they don't bother you the same way.
Right. And I think that she also, as the show developed, I think they tweaked certain things about her, including one of the things that I really didn't like about the pilot, which was that she seemed to be a bad doctor.
Yeah.
And for me, it's really hard for me. It's one thing to be House and be like a great doctor but a jerk. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to be kind of a bad OBGYN. And early on, they made it seem like she didn't really care about her patients very much. She only cared about money. She was sort of neglectful of them and insensitive to them. And I think as time has gone on, they have found ways for her to be funny and for her to have some of these, like, clothes horse silliness tendencies without implying that she doesn't care about her patients. And when you set your show in a doctor's office, I think that is an important adjustment.
It's kind of gone the Legally Blonde route in that respect, where the whole premise is like, I can be all of these things, you know, and
totally.
Like jam out to the latest pop tunes and also dress in clashing patterns and still be amazing.
Oh, God, her power clashing game is so on point. I admire it.
That's true.
I think one thing that's interesting about the show, or the things I really loved about it, is number one, it took on things like religion. Like the characters would have faith for one reason or another. The Danny character was Catholic. And everyone had very specific idiosyncrasies. Like one of my favorite aspects of the show, and this is me with my Boston bias showing, is that she's from Boston. She went to school at Dartmouth. She has a thing for Dartmouth bros for a while. Adam Pally played a character like
Pally.
That. And it was so, it was such a weird little specific joke. You know, her father was really into the Red Sox. And I also have a weird immigrant father who's weirdly specifically interested in the Red Sox and will like talk to me about relief pitching. And I'm like, what do you know about this? This is so weird. And like her mother is like, wants to be a character actress in Greater Boston Theater. Just these weird kind of flourishes. I remember once the mini character dated an evangelical preacher.
She sure did.
Was
that
like,
got pretty serious.
Yes. Yeah. And I've been to one of those churches and this was spot on. Like he's like a DJ. He's a little too cool.
He's like a very cool dude.
Very
he's
too
like a very
intense.
Cool preacher, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like the church service is like a rave. And I remember thinking, no one talks about faith at all on TV, much less in comedy, much less in romance, and the clashes that that can bring and that sort of thing. It's usually just played for like, these people are jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
end.
I did go back to this show in preparation for this segment and watch the entire Hulu season, the first 13 episodes, which is a half season. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was going to. I thought I would just go in, see the first two or three, and then skip to the end. I'm glad I didn't, because I think it's more interesting to me because, as I've said before, people come together only in a handful of ways, but people stay together or don't for a variety of different reasons.
Yeah,
that's
a
lot more interesting. I completely reject this old saw that, you know, once your main characters get together, then the whole show is over because
we all reject it.
The story doesn't end when two people get together. It only begins.
Right.
I'm talking as a guy who has been with the same dude for 18 years. It better not end when they get together. So I think they were doing something really interesting this season, and they built toward injecting a layer of sadness, a real melancholy that if I had skipped, I would not have felt it was earned. But that last episode, the 13th episode, is a really good piece of American television.
It is.
It
is. And I think for me, one of the things that's really effective about it is they come up with what's very much a romantic kind of trope, right? And here we're going to spoil, I think, probably some of the plot through these first three and a half seasons, essentially. But there's kind of this trope in which, you know, when she and Danny finally are a couple and then she's pregnant. And so they decide to get together and they decide, OK, well, it's just going to be you and me and our baby and everything's going to be great. And then you start to see them having some of the problems that you would have if you really did that. Like if you really said, OK, we haven't been together very long. We wouldn't have decided to get super, super serious necessarily right now. But because I got pregnant, we decided we're going to try to push forward. They suddenly have a lot of stuff going on because they didn't navigate it in a normal way. So they kind of have these big romantic moments that they've played for this couple that then you have to deal with what that would really mean if you really did it. And if you really had this big declaration of love based around kind of accelerating your relationship, that's what would happen to you.
Or if you look at the data, it is the normal way, right? If you look at the current landscape of marriage and cohabitation, that is how a lot of people get together.
Right.
And the truth is, it doesn't make you any less of a commitment phobe once that happens. And I think the show played the reality of that out, you right. know, that he's very reluctant to marry for all kinds of reasons, but it almost doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that the show did really well also is it really showed how a power imbalance can play out over the course of time in a relationship. Like, this is a character where she does feel strongly about her work. And it's not always clear that the man in her life, her partner in her life, respects her work the same way.
It's true. Mm-hmm.
And they don't improve that.
Right.
They don't make him a better guy in that
right.
respect.
No, it's right.
Over the course of two seasons.
It's
you
right.
like him more, so it's more painful when she makes that realization. And I should say, these are not spoilers, because, like, that's the thing about rom-coms, mm-hmm. right? Like, you get together,
right.
there's going to be a fight, so this
right.
is not a spoiler. But that was something that really, yeah. I found really striking.
This show, the reason I kept watching is because I got more invested, because I thought I was seeing something I don't normally see on television. There's other shows like Married that kind of deal with this mm-hmm. same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. How do we stay together? How does a couple stay together? And Married was a good show that had a more acidic bite than this particular show does.
Yeah.
The way it kept me going was the casting. Eliza Coop shows up as the neighbor, Garrett Dillahunt, being great and not nice. Not a good guy.
But, and again, weird.
Yeah.
yeah.
Everybody's
yeah.
weird.
He's a weird dude. And Ed Weeks, who is the British doctor we talked about earlier, Jeremy, who is an interesting character. He's kind of woven in and out of different, I think, roles in that show.
Yeah, and Kristen Milioti, too. That last episode, that 13th episode, the trope is they go back to show you what this relationship was between these two people at the very, very beginning. So it's doing really good work. It's showing basically a Danny that I didn't see. Over the course of the two seasons I didn't watch, they put a lot of effort into rounding him out, making him nicer. And so to see him at the very beginning and to see him at the end and see that there isn't much.
Yeah.
Someone
yeah.
rounding out is not really
which
going
is a
well.
Testament to Chris Messina.
Yeah.
I'm a
yeah.
Chris Messina completist.
Me too.
I mean, if that guy, if he puts out a video reading the phone book, I'm here
yeah.
for it.
You know that he's the clueless clerk who can't find the shoes books in You've Got Mail, right? At the end of... Okay, so seriously.
No, I'm not
surprised. At the end of You've Got Mail... when Meg Ryan is visiting the big bookstore where the clueless, dumb
Books.
Clerk, she's at Fox Books, the clueless, dumb clerk who doesn't know anything and who stands for kind of the death of the independent bookstore. I was looking at that movie and I was like, of course it's Chris Messina because he's in everything.
He is.
And I want to ask a couple of supporting cast questions. How much Morgan is too much Morgan is my question. Morgan is the male nurse played by Ike Barinholtz.
Mm-hmm. Who is he a co-writer on the show?
Yeah.
He's a producer.
Yeah, he's kind of one of her major creative partners in that show, if not Kaling's major. Partner.
I think it's not that he's too much. I think that Mindy is a show that, for better or worse, has tripled down on the kind of zinger machine approach to scripting, where this is not how people talk in real life, obviously, at all. And so there are lots of characters who just kind of, from the peanut gallery, throw out something so random. And sometimes it lands and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, I think it's part of the facade of how the show is built.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you don't like one of those characters, well, you know, fast forward, because yeah, they're going to show up every
right.
like 7 to 9 minutes to like make you pay attention
yeah.
again. It's like there's an older character, like a woman nurse who works at the front
yes,
desk
there is.
Who will just say something about being an alcoholic or
Beth Grant, know. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. yeah.
The great and
really,
good Beth Grant.
Really funny. But it's always so random.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay,
mm-hmm.
that's my, you know, weird kind of cartoon moment of it. And then there's another assistant. I think it's Zosia Roquemore. She plays a character called Tamara, who mm-hmm. basically plays beautiful New York black woman with braids.
Yeah,
who,
yeah.
You know, there was a whole episode about CP time, it was called,
yeah.
which you were supposed to think was colored people time, but she informs you quickly it's caramel princess time.
Yeah.
My
yeah.
husband embraced that.
Yeah.
He's like,
so,
I've seen that.
Margaret, are you a Morgan person?
I am a Morgan person, but I have kind of a different perspective on the strength of the guest casting
okay.
from Glenn, just in terms of like the choices that they make in terms of who to bring on are consistently excellent.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes they bring on too many people and they don't really do a great job of figuring out how they fit into the story. And it means that some of the characters who've been there since the beginning get a little underserved. Like, I think Tamara gets a little underserved.
I
feel like
fair.
Her character is not as consistently written as Morgan. And there's a podcast that's taped locally called Black Girls Talking that I've listened to a bunch, and they
are very, very down on Tamara. And I had a real journey with them on that where I was like, I feel like she's fine.
Yeah.
And then I actually went back and I watched the show and I was like, oh, crap.
Yeah. It's pretty weak. But I think I just felt that all those characters that weren't the main ones,
they're sort of tight.
They don't really get much to do.
Yeah.
Morgan is great. I think Danny's great. I think Mindy's family is consistently really good. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm not as sold, for example, on the new wacky characters for this season, Jody and Colette.
Which is Garrett Dillahunt and
who essentially plays Southern stereotypes, by Southern stereotype like standards.
You know? Yeah. Like it's just like whatever wacky line they could come up with that came out of the Southern stereotype bin, they throw in there, and I don't have a coherent sense of them as characters.
Yeah.
And that's one thing when it's brand new characters who've been around for a season, but it's a different thing in the case of Tamara, where I still feel like sometimes that's going on. Whereas you have this super defined, weird idea of who Morgan is.
That's a good point.
I could watch Find Out New Quirks about him all the time. I'm especially interested in his relationship with dogs, predictably.
Yeah. That is predictable. And they've done some things that I think they just have had trouble figuring out how to fully flesh out, one of which is the midwives played by the Duplass brothers, who I think are funny sometimes, but I don't think they ever fully got that to do whatever it was they wanted it to do. And I think another one actually was Adam Pally, who I love. And anybody who wants to import the cast of Happy Endings, I think that's wonderful. And between him and Eliza Coop, they have kind of been doing that. But I'm not sure they ever really quite got that dude to be more than just Adam Pally being Adam Pally, who's funny and great. And
maybe it's like a rapper who has come up with famous people, and so they know too many people.
Yeah, I think that's exactly
it. They know too many cool people. Like, Mindy Kaling, literally is too cool for the stature of her show, and she knows too many people, and so they all come on because they're like, of course I'll come on.
And all those dudes, Bill Hader's been on there.
Yeah. She could actually use, fewer guest stars in a way.
I feel like the Mindy Project's eyes are always bigger than its plate. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's what my mom always told me at buffets.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point.
But for problems for a comedy to have, that's kind of a my diamond shoes are too tight problem.
Mm-hmm. It is. I agree. All right. Well, I will be very curious to hear how many of you out there are Mindy Project people and whether you've stuck with it. I have seen a couple, not necessarily in order. I've seen three from the new half season. I did enjoy them very much. It continues to be an interesting direction that they're going with this story.
The showrunner claims it's lighter than the last episode, which it couldn't help but be.
I would say yes and no, mm-hmm. in a way. But again, I would be interested to hear how many of you are with it still and enjoying it, because I do still really enjoy it. It grew into something that is kind of a favorite of mine. Anyway, when we come back, we are going to talk about romantic comedy in general, because if you followed the beginning of this show, a lot of it had to do with Mindy Kaling's love of rom-coms and desire to kind of play around with some of those tropes. So we're going to talk about that after this.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from LearnVest. LearnVest is an online financial advice company focused on empowering people nationwide to make smart decisions with their money. If you want to know how aggressively to pay down your student loans, LearnVest can help with that. If you want to know how much you should put aside for saving or contribute to your retirement account, yep, they're on it. They'll create a custom financial plan. Plus, they pair you with a financial planner to help keep you on track. To see a sample plan and get a $50 credit, go to learnvest.com/happy.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about one of television's romantic comedies, The Mindy Project. Now we're going to talk a little about romantic comedies in general. Now, when we started talking about this topic, I will candidly say that I think Audie and Margaret and I are all people who have watched a certain amount of romantic comedy. Glenn, on the other hand, sort of said, I don't know if I'm the right guy for a conversation about romantic comedy. I want to start by, if you can tell me, buddy, where this puts you when I say romantic comedy. What happens in your brain? How did you get to this place of hostility?
It's just if you grow up on TV, if you grow up on movies, you see the same things over and over again. And so it's like any other genre. There's some genres that are for people. I am not a meet cute followed by a misunderstanding followed by Judy Greer saying, go to him. I'm not that guy. That's not my thing. But, and they also, they traffic in these things you humans call emotions. So it's, again, it's just not, it's not for me. So I have here a list of all the romantic comedies that I have enjoyed over years on this planet.
Oh, yeah, I want to hear this.
Good, I want to hear this too.
1996's Beautiful Thing. Okay, there we go. I'm done.
That's the only one.
What
you've
is it about that?
Enjoyed.
I want to know.
Beautiful Thing is a. There's no reason in the world why it should get to me, but it does. It's this British film based on a play that I actually saw in London in 1994. It was made into a film in 1996 about these two kids who are in council flats, tower blocks, basically British public housing. It's sweet, but it's also British, so it's not too sweet, right? It's got a layer of
So are they,
acid.
Like, outsider-y kids, or what's the deal?
They're just, like, one's athletic and one's not, and there's a single mom, and there's, you know, the best friend, and it's very, like, it ticks all kinds of boxes, but it is leavened, it is buoyed by this all this Mama Cass music, mm-hmm. And it's just, it's... I think it hit me at the right time, and ultimately, this is might be why romantic comedies work and you or don't, because I see men and women getting together all the time. I don't feel particularly invested in these stories. This is a story about kids coming to terms with self-acceptance, which is its own thing, and then wider community acceptance. And, you know, it doesn't do everything particularly right. It is incredibly sweet. And another one, the 2011 film, I think, called Weekend, which kind of is also British. Maybe that's the thing. And I'm also dealing with the fact that most gay romantic comedies are terrible.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah, How much of this is identity and looking on the screen and really feeling like, okay, seems like it's working for y'all?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's outsider looking in, seeing these tropes recur and recur and recur. And, you know, when they speak to me, but they don't speak to me very often.
One of the things I want to get at is not all romantic comedy takes place inside of a movie that is, or a TV show that is, on the whole, a romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. Inside of Bridesmaids, right, is like a quarter of that movie mm-hmm. is a romantic comedy with her and Chris O'Dowd. Mm-hmm. When you see a movie like that, do you tune that part out? Can you take it in a small dose when it's part of something else?
When I start to feel like I'm getting this story and not the story, you know, and when I'm getting these people and not people, I think that's when I respond.
Interesting. Very interesting. So, Margaret, if I asked you to name a couple of kind of foundational romantic comedies for you, where does your mind go?
I mean, the first place my mind goes is When Harry Met Sally. And then the second place my mind goes is Bringing Up Baby.
Yep. You have your vintage and then your slightly less vintage.
Yeah. And, I mean, there are others. My best friend and I have a scale that we use to rate romantic comedies. It's called the 27 Dress Scale.
Sure.
And it's called that because in our scale, 27 dresses comes in at exactly 27 on the romantic comedy scale, which seems very low, I understand. But what you need to understand is that anything above a 20 is something you would sit and watch on TBS with commercials.
Fair. What I thought you were going to say is that it was called the 27 dresses scale because 27 dresses is the exact middle of the scale.
it's roughly the middle of the scale.
I think that's generous. If we're being
How
honest.
How recently have you watched 27 dresses? Because it's better than you remember.
There are a couple of people that I have gotten into intense Twitter discussions about romantic comedy with. One of whom is Guy Branum, who's the host of Pop Rocket, who's a friend of Glenn's, who initially, when we talked about romantic comedy, was saying, like, he was like, I can't believe that you would watch 27 Dresses. And I said, Guy, go watch 27 Dresses. And he came back and he said, basically what Margaret said, it's better than I thought.
Yeah.
I don't know that I fully brought him around, but he disrespects me less than he originally did. How about you, Adi? What are kind of foundational romantic comedies
for you? I don't have a good answer to that question. I do think that I am fully embracing what is out there now, and especially on television. Number one, I think the anti-rom-com idea is now the default setting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Rom-coms as a form must always be smuggled into other movies a lot of times through the eyes of men and straight male protagonists, which is fine.
Some examples of that would be?
Some examples I think would be, Knocked Up.
Sure.
Right? Nice. Like, you get pregnant, but what will the guy do? Okay, sure, I'll sit through that,
But what about him?
But what about him? I mean, who will he smoke weed with now?
What does Seth Rogen do when stuck with the possibility of winding up with Katherine Heigl?
Right, so, I understand that. I think that's interesting. I also think that the acidic, caustic, this sort of river of acid that runs through a lot of these comedies now means that you're sitting through something that is defiantly telling you, like, we don't like this rom-com business. You know, like, right. Mindy Kaling is messing with it
right.
because she loves it. You mm-hmm. know, the penultimate fight of this of the last season begins while they're watching When Harry Met Sally in the movie theater and getting into this argument. She's like, I love this, and she's teasing you about mm-hmm. it. But mm-hmm. then there are other shows that I absolutely love watching, like Casual on Hulu, mm-hmm. like You're the Worst on FX,
such a good
like
show.
Catastrophe, which you guys have mm-hmm. talked about on this show on Amazon, yeah. which are epic in how they can take the intimacy that comes from romance and show you what it looks like when it's weaponized.
Yeah.
or show you what it looks like when it's in an environment of alcohol and drugs or depression or a myriad of other things. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like what little romance there is merely a carrier for the bigger ideas. That's not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
But it makes for a very, to me, very different landscape than what we're all talking about here in terms of just sort of like movies where right. there's a happy ever after.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I don't feel like they make that many straight up romantic comedies anymore. What I'm saying is like big mainstream romantic comedies like yeah. they did in, you know, especially like the 90s and I would say the early aughts. You just don't see as many of them
yeah.
anymore.
Or and if you do, it's like the Forgetting Sarah Marshall kind of
right.
thing.
And part of that is the collapse of the middle that has affected a whole bunch of kinds of movies. Basically anything made for grown-ups that's not the movie market is kind of going into this bifurcated thing where you have little movies and then you have blockbusters.
Right.
And there's been kind of a collapse, other than animated movies, which tend to be on the blockbuster scale. There's been something of a collapse of certain kinds of family movies, like live action family movies you don't get as much of as you used to. Mm-hmm. Linda Obst's book, she is a movie producer and used to have a bunch of other jobs doing development and production of movies. And she's talked about this collapse of the middle. And I think it has affected a lot of types of movies, and romantic comedies are definitely one of them, because for a while, that was a genre that, if you were me, you could kind of live on that. You could watch a ton of those. There was mm-hmm. always a new, you know, whether it was like Meg Ryan for a while or Julia yeah. Roberts for a while.
Great
they
days.
They just kind of made them. And now I feel like they just kind of don't. And I think you're right. They're either smuggled into something else. Like I said about Bridesmaids, you'll see a strain of romantic comedy. It's like that. In the heat, there's this little tiny thread of a romance between Sandra Bullock and Marlon Wayans, which is barely addressed. And it just yeah. runs through the movie in this very thin channel. But it's really charming. And I watched it and sort of thought, I'd watch more.
Though that might be due to other issues, given what we know about Hollywood and race and the pairing of leads, right?
It certainly could be. But I think in any sense, it wasn't going to be the main focus of the movie. It was always mm-hmm. going to be a side point. I don't know. I feel the same way as Audie. I would say Catastrophe, I think, is more straight up romantic than like You're the Worst and stuff like that. Catastrophe
yeah.
is pretty... Once they get past kind of the initial, are we going to get together? Is this just going to be like a fling? Maybe I'm influenced by having just watched the second season.
No,
but that's a pretty romantic show to me, actually.
I completely agree with you.
But they go out of their way to never say I love you, right? That's like sort of verboten to say those words.
I think they...
And it's still very funny, and it still mines the humor in the situations that come from just the everyday of being
right.
in a relationship.
And I think you're right. If you watch the second season, which is only 6 episodes and just dropped on Amazon recently, if you watch the second season, toward the end of it, they are hinting at another one of these things that's probably about to come into these people's lives and make them difficult, which mm-hmm. once you're parents is even more challenging. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to make the point that I think Catastrophe is a comedy that kind of dispensed with the romance, what I consider romance. Maybe I'm just narrow. I'm defining
no,
it way
you.
Too narrowly. Yeah, they totally snuck it in because I think of romance as people coming together. I like what I like about Catastrophe as a British B, that it's about struggling to stay together, wondering if staying together is worth it. What does this relationship mean to them?
Hmm.
It means different things. We see that power kind of go back and forth. That is a conflict that is interesting. And it's again, it's not the kind of thing you see a lot. So
I have a question for the group. Given what we've talked about in television and the television landscape generally, is it that rom-coms are actually better served by serial formats, that mm. in order to get past lazy writing or stereotypes about the coming together, you actually need to have a kind of build and you need to be in the relationship with these people for some time. Whereas I feel like somehow movies, just by nature of the format, it's like meet, come together or don't come together, sunset. Mm-hmm. It's just like very hard to do anything after, if that makes any sense.
I think that's right.
Not a romantic comedy, but the movie Take This Waltz mm-hmm. is a movie,
oh,
Sarah
yeah.
Pauly, where yeah. In the end, the characters who come together, they try and show an after, mm-hmm. and it's like literally in montage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like somehow you can't live there with a movie.
I agree.
I think that's right.
Well, I think that they're sort of separate questions, right? Which is, there's this genre, the romantic comedy, that has very specific beats, and I think that's most commonly featured in movies. And it has its satisfactions and its disappointments. And then there's the idea of, like, love stories. And I think love stories are absolutely better served by serialization, because you get to see the developing dynamic between those people, and you do get to move out of that space where it's two people getting together and into the space where it's two people being together. I'd like to stick up for the trite joy of watching two people get together, even in a very, like, rote sort of way. Because I think the joy of watching two beautiful people with great chemistry interacting in beautiful settings is one of the purest things that cinema can offer.
Hmm. It's also trying to bottle something, right? Like, there is nothing, you know, I guess I'll just say it for myself, but I feel like there's nothing sexier than just before the kiss,
mm-hmm.
right? The
yeah.
coming together. And what we have forfeited for our relationships is that moment, right? Like, and other things are
right.
gained in a relationship. I've been in one, a long one too, not as long as Glenn. But there is nothing quite like the moments just before. And that's what those movies give you when they're done mm-hmm. well, is like that moment. And you can hit play and, like, mm-hmm. be in that place. And
yeah.
I think there's something very magical about that.
Yeah.
Well, right. Kaling herself says she loves the romantic comedy as a genre, but she loves it and she thinks of it as a subset of the science fiction genre.
Yes.
of all these contrivances that you have to buy. And that makes sense to me. Because I think in this culture, our fairy tales end with happily ever after. In Russian culture, they end with happily ever after until they both died on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you get happiness in Russia.
Yeah.
And I think in Arabian Nights, it's something like they both lived happily until, of course, death came, which destroys all happiness. And it's like,
something
good.
Subtle.
Nice.
Yeah.
Got
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the things that's interesting about this concept of whether things are romantic, is it romantic? Is it comedic? And then is it a romantic comedy?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's interesting is when I go back and look at that output of romantic movies from, you know, let's say When Harry Met Sally in 1989 through, you know, maybe 2005-ish, it's not a romantic comedy. The most romantic love story to me from that period is Love and Basketball, which is a not really a romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a romantic drama, although it has, you know, comedic elements and great conversation and stuff like that. But I've said mm-hmm. a million times that my favorite romance from that period is Love and Basketball. And part of the reason for that is that in your typical kind of romantic comedy setup, and I think this is part of what Glenn is saying, you do get these really weird setups that very often don't make any sense because you have to keep people apart for the entire movie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The reasons to do that, I mean, as you become an adult, you realize that what you really want is not that moment when you say, which you say, like, oh, I hate that person. I would never be with them. And then later, of course, you do. You want that moment where you go, ah, yes, this, I'm going to pursue this. And you pursue it like a grown up. And that becomes mm-hmm. what's romantic to you. As opposed to, like, even the ones that I really love. Look, I'm with Margaret. I have great warm feelings about When Harry Met Sally. If you go back and watch that movie, it does not hang together.
No.
And I mentioned this on Twitter over the weekend. Mm-hmm. That guy would never wind up with anyone who gave him that little reassurance that he's
yeah.
hilarious.
That but far and away, the most convincing romantic couple in that movie are Jess and Marie.
Of course.
The secondary couple, which is
of
often
course.
The case.
And so if you look at it too hard, those people actually don't have a very good reason to wind up together. they don't have a good reason to sleep together. It's actually a very bad idea.
Ugh.
And then you get the premises like Sleepless in Seattle, which are essentially magical thinking premises, mm-hmm. where that's very much science
that's
fiction.
That's definitely science
fiction.
I mean,
the idea
fiction,
that
yeah.
you don't meet and you don't know each other, but there's something going on that's kind of bigger than both of you. And I mean, you know, it's not life. It's a romantic idea, but I don't know if I find it that romantic of a relationship story.
I have this particular hobby horse about romantic comedies, which is I feel like they are subject to a judgment of realism that we don't apply the same way to other types of genre films. Like,
sure.
I think Mindy's observation that you have to appreciate it basically like sci-fi is very, very apt, which is like if you go into a horror movie, you know, and your attitude is like, oh, like, why would she run up the staircase when the door's right there? Then, like, you're not working with the film to produce the superficial reality it wants you to make to get to a certain point. And I think romantic comedies are the same way, and that there should be a better vocabulary for appreciating them under specific generic constraints.
I will agree with you, but the distinction I would make is, for me, it's not that I expect them to be realistic, because realism in general is an objective good. I like for them to be believable in the sense that, and I as I write this on Monday, I just wrote about this on the blog today.
That's a great piece.
One of the things that I really love about Catastrophe is that because of the way they build that relationship, I believe them as being in love with each other. And therefore, the stakes of the romantic part of that story are more important to me because, and maybe this goes back to what we talked about with serialized television, I believe when they are playing a scene together, Rob Delaney and Sharon Horgan, when they are playing a scene together, I believe that those characters love each other, like each other, know each other, and are invested in that relationship. So believability plays into whether or not something is romantic. It's like if it's not believable, part of what that means is I don't really think this is what love is like, and therefore it doesn't seem love-like to me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And that's a prime reason why Sleepless in Seattle has never been my movie.
Margaret and Linda argue about the realism of romantic comedies this week on Pop Culture.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't look back on that period very fondly, you know, maybe for the reasons that Glenn felt. Like,
I was
feel like you're sort of outside of
that. I was just going to go back to this because you mentioned...
You mentioned Love and Basketball.
Yeah.
But that's like a good example of that run of, like, if you think about those movies, some of which had black directors during that period, those films are always great for the reasons that they are a little bit of a mashup genre-wise. Mm-hmm. Like, they're kind of doing a lot of things. And whereas something like You've Got Mail or Sleepless in Seattle is just like the studio greenlit a thing.
I was just going to say,
put a child in it, put a Starry Night, and meet these people at the airport.
There was not an efficient machine turning out these movies with people who were not white. There might have been individual movies, individual directors that kind of anointed stars who could make them over and over and over again, could make them together over and over again. There are such films, but you know, it's one of the many genres that I think has hurt itself by kind of not responding to the audience very well. And there are now all of like the Best Man movies and these kind of big ensemble movies, but I still don't know that you're getting a lot of straight up romantic comedies.
No, and those films often serve as a reminder as like how underutilized all those actors are.
For real.
You're just like, everyone is beautiful with great teeth and a good sense of comedic timing. Ergo, Hollywood doesn't know what to do with them.
Exactly.
Because they can only be the black best friend in some other movie.
Well, and it's like you would see people like Taraji P. Henson in movies like this prior to when she finally got something great to do, which turned out to be on TV. So it's like, I mean, I think you're exactly right. You go and look at the ensemble cast and you say, you know, you should not be able to get this many people in one movie for anything that anybody can afford.
Yeah, and that flaw goes to television as well. The only romantic comedy that serves anything well in the way of diverse casting is hands down Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a show that... Stay with me, people. I didn't think I'd be into it either. I have reflexive dislike of musicals. Reflexive, okay? And, you know, the main character is in love with her boyfriend from high school, and he is Asian. And he's an Asian bro. We interviewed her, and she talked about this, like, making this kind of specific stereotype based on her experiences growing up in California. And another love interest is definitely Southeast Asian. And it feels like a street I would actually walk down in California, whereas 98% of romantic comedies, my major flaw, and like Mindy included, is you're just like, where is this? Like, is this taking place like in the Gap? Is this taking place like where is this place?
Is this
really supposed to be
Gap?
New York? You know, like it's very confusing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's that weird sort of rubber stamping the self-sorting of our culture that mm-hmm. I think isn't my experience of American life. I don't know if it's where I live and where I work, and that very well may be the case.
No, it's true. It's true. I think that's a great point, and I think it is interesting to kind of compare, like, that there is that little bit of distance, like you're talking about, that I'm sure I did not experience.
Yeah. It's like playing with Barbie. It's like when you're a little brown girl, you're like, oh, this is a thing.
Yeah.
But you might as well be playing with a Matchbox car. Like, it has just as much, like, to do with who you are in your life.
Yeah. All right. Well, I will be eager to hear from all of you what you think about rom-coms, some of your favorites. Are we right or are we wrong about some of the things that we identified? You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. And that brings us to our final and favorite segment of This Week and Every Week. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
There's a new series on Netflix called Netflix Presents The Characters. It's a series of half-hour comedy specials. Each one features a different comedian whose names may or may not be known to you, probably not, and they play different characters. There's 8 episodes. They're all directed by the same guy, Andrew Gaynard. I haven't seen them all, but I can recommend a few. The one with Natasha Rothwell, the one with Lauren Lapkus, the one with John Early, and especially, for me anyway, the one with a comedian called Kate Berlant. She plays an artist, a fine artist in New York City. If you have spent any time in the art world, or even art world adjacent, as I dated an artist briefly a long time ago when ichthyosaurs swam the turbid seas.
Uh-huh.
She nails the preciousness, the egotism of the artist, and most importantly, the sycophancy of everyone around them in a really lacerating, smart, funny way. Girls plays with this a little bit, but it's much gentler. It's much more favorable. This is much more specific and much funnier. So that's Netflix Presents The Characters. Also, there was an interview with a guy by the name of Ta-Nehisi Coates on All Things Considered.
Heard of it.
Uh-huh. He is, of course...
Sarah podcast.
Yes. He's, of course, writing Black Panther now. He is an essayist, a poet, I learned in this particular interview. And Black Panther is really good. He's getting off to a good start. He's doing the service that he needs to do. And I recommend checking out that comic, but I really recommend checking out this interview that he did with Audie Cornish, because she got him to open up and share some of his fears in a way. One of the things I say all the time is that when people who write prose go to write comics, they just weigh it down with all kinds of prose. They don't trust the art. He is doing a great job of trusting the art, because I learned that he was a poet originally, and that makes so much sense. It's a great piece. If you hear it, there's a lot more stuff that didn't make it to air in the web build of it.
And by the time people are hearing this, you will also be able to hear an extended cut of it in the
awesome
Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast feed.
Oh, there you
great,
go.
Because we live to serve.
It's great.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Audie Cornish, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
I just have a small one this time, a humble offering, which is that recently I joined Instagram, which people may have heard of the Instagram.
Uh-huh.
I'm new to this community.
Sure.
And so far, my favorite Instagram account is that of the TSAs.
Oh, yes.
For the airport. Uh-huh. And I feel like it should have several slogans, one being so many knives, and alternately, you put your weed in there, because every post is something along those lines. I had no idea the many ways you could try and hide. I mean, not me, TSA, if you can hear me, but other people.
Right, other people.
Try and hide knives. In just the last couple of days, there was a gas-powered chainsaw discovered in Chicago O'Hare.
Sure.
Throwing stars that were built into a carved out compartment in a wooden cell phone case.
Well, you need that.
But exactly. I mean, I can't even get my iPhone out of the case.
Yeah.
The regular little black, just don't. And then my favorite, an oversized bottle of liquor in a carry-on bag in Detroit. that had five dead endangered seahorses inside.
I
the
never,
photos
I
are
never,
exactly what you
never
are picturing. anyway, so it's
drunk
one of the
seahorses.
I have found when I'm on Instagram, I don't want to see more pictures of friends and people I know. Sorry, friends and people I know. And their children. Like, I already see that on, like, Facebook and everything.
Whatever.
Yeah, I'm like, cute, got it. But then there's nothing that brings me the same joy as, like, seeing our nation's security officials hard at work actually catching a thing instead of patting down my hair. They actually are catching things like throwing stars.
Yeah.
So get it, TSA. It's great. TSA Instagram.
I very much agree with you. I follow that account also. Margaret Willison, what is making you happy this week, Cool Hoop?
Predictably, I've brought three things. It was
sure.
two. But last night, my newsletter partner Sophie and I hosted a live tweet of Tangerine, which we'd never seen before.
It's a great movie.
Oh my God. We'll be talking about almost nothing but how great that movie is for the next 4 months. Mm. So that's one. So thing two, a book, I know, shocking, called A Bellwether Rhapsody by Kate Reculia. I read it in January, sort of on a whim because it was available at my library. And someone at a presentation I gave had recommended it as a read-alike for Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell. And I get asked questions about Rainbow all the time, so I'm always looking for books that are good read-alikes, and they're hard to find because she has very specific books. This book is one of my new favorite books. It's rare that you encounter a book and you read it and you're like, oh, this author has all of the same reference points as me. And isn't that fun? So for me, that's always strange. What's rarer is when you encounter that and you're like, they have all of the same reference points as me. In this case, Agatha Christie novels, The Westing Game, being like a teenager who's theatrically inclined, David Bowie, The Shining. And then they make something with that amalgamation of familiar references that is as unique as what it came from and feels immediately as essential. I feel like in 15 years, I'm going to read books and I'm going to say, this is someone who loved Bellwether Rhapsody as much as I did.
Ah, got it. Bellwether Rhapsody is
great,
your book.
By Kate Reculia. And then an album. So there's a band called Bad Bad Hats. They're based out of Minnesota. And I got to see them open for a band I like from Portland. And they're great jangly guitar girl music with really, really smart, funny, insightful lyrics. But the most important thing I can convey to the listeners is that you can get both of their albums for free on their label's website, Afternoon Records, as long as you sign up for their mailing list. And I cannot think of a better soundtrack for your April than Bad Bad Hats.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Margaret Willison. Okay, so before I tell you my official what's making me happy, I will mention that we are still in the middle of our really fun April special offer for the month of April, which is if you try out the NPR One app, which, by the way, is really good and is a really good way to listen to lots of great stuff. If you try out the NPR One app, you can listen to the show on Thursday instead of on Friday. It is available exclusively on NPR One on Thursday. So the way that you would get it, by the way, on Thursday is you want to search for Pop Culture Happy Hour, and it's going to be the first thing that pops up should be the preview of the week's episode. And so we did this last week. We know that a bunch of you tried it, and we really appreciate it. We thank you so much. I would not tell you to try it if I didn't think it was great. I think it's great, and also it gives you the show a day early, so what's better than that? So NPR One, that is one thing making me happy. Also making me happy, about to come back, one of my favorite comedies, HBO's Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to watch a handful of screeners over the weekend, and it was so exciting because I love Silicon Valley. And I am not necessarily the most obvious target of kind of tech bro satire, and yet I am a total sucker for this show. And what I love about it is they don't make too many. They make some and then they go away for a good period of time, which allows this show, which has some predictable rhythms, not predictable rhythms, but like repeated rhythms, right? This entire show is about this guy who starts a little company and then he just goes through this cycle where he thinks he's about to make progress with this business and then something terrible happens and he gets crushed. And then he has another plan and he gets crushed. And then, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so because they take long breaks, they can kind of repeat that arc with it always feeling fresh. They're also remarkably good at coming up with like fake tech companies.
I think it's like the first real Silicon Valley satire.
It is. There is a new one in this season where you feel like the setup is this is going to be something dumb that a tech company does. And what it does is both so dumb and yet so believable that it's one of those things like Spinal Tap that's just barely too much.
Yes, that's
in this wonderful way, and I enjoyed it so much. It is the home of a bunch of wonderful actors, including friend of the show Kumail Nanjiani, and a bunch of other people that we like a lot, T.J. Miller and, oh gosh, Martin Starr and oodles of people. Not so much the women. I would love it if it had a presence of women. I understand.
Like part of the satire part.
I understand why it doesn't, but I still wish that it did. But about to come back. Silicon Valley, watch it. I love it. I also saw the season premiere of Veep, also great, which will premiere on the same night. So everything is good in the land of HBO comedy. They're bringing those back. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, Audie at NPR Audie, and Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks so much to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.